Start the meeting.
All right, thank you. Good afternoon, gentlemen. We will conduct roll call. You'll note at the top of your agenda, you'll see there that we have included all three of the executive orders that tie into the executive orders in terms of COVID pandemic, et cetera. We will make a determination based on any changes to those as we go into October's board meeting on what the in-person meeting content may look like within our small boardroom. But again, as we have for months and months here, we're continuing today's September 28th, 2021 board meeting with remote access and limiting the number of folks in the boardroom to accommodate social distancing. If I could start with roll call, I'd appreciate that. President Wolverine?
Here.
Vice President Hickman?
Here.
Director Starr?
Here.
Director Moreland?
Here.
Director Division 4 is vacant. Council Cooper?
Here.
Information System Manager Martinez?
Here.
Environmental Health and Safety Manager Perrin?
Here.
Finance Manager Wong?
I'm here.
Power Division Manager Leon?
Here.
Regulatory and Compliance Manager McKillop?
Here.
Myself, General Manager Mosley. Now, who do we have participating remotely?
We have two anonymous, one by the last name of Ackerman. We have Brian Nash from RMCK's firm, and Charles, who I assume is Charles Sharp.
Okay, thank you. And as we do each month, at the end of the board meeting, if you could send me correspondence on those names so I have it accurate and spelled correctly, I'd appreciate it, Art. Want to do the pledge of
allegiance? Yeah. Okay, good moving to the pledge. Salute.
Pledge of allegiance to the flag of the United States of America and to the republic for which it stands, one nation, under God, indivisible, with liberty and justice for all.
And if I may, Mr. President, you'll see that today's agenda has shifted around a little bit from what you're accustomed to. So what we would like to do is, for sensitivity of time, we have Brian Nash on the phone who performed the annual financial report. So we brought him up to the top, and then it's up to Mr. Nash if post that report, if he wants to continue and participate, welcome to do so, Mr. Nash. But otherwise, we wanted to, you know, be sensitive to your allotment of time. And then you'll see also that we've moved up today closed session right after staff reports. And then we'll go back into open session for business items and information items.
Okay.
Thank you.
Great.
All right. This is a...
Thank you.
Brian was good enough to prepare for us an agenda package or a sheet, which will just list an outline of his presentation and discussion on the audited financial reports. Let me just go ahead and turn it over to Brian and allow him to speak to you as to what the report, as to how the report came together and his findings, and then I will be available and Wraith will be available as well to respond to any questions as well. Brian, are you on okay?
I'm here. Can you hear me?
And Steve, you may... Yes, we can. We can hear you fine. You may mention that I put the documentations that are placed out of sequence, so I'm not sure how Mr. Nash would like to start. What happened in the board packet?
Okay. Brian, up to you.
Okay. So, I did open the board package in the order that the four documents that we issued are the financial statement, then the appropriations report, and the governance letter. It says governance letter right below our header, and management letter. So those are the four documents that we issued. I understand that you have there on the screen package. You look at page one of the financial statements, that's our audit opinion. So our audit opinion is a unmodified opinion. That means we had to make no modifications to say the financial statements were issued in accordance with generally accepted accounting principles. If you want to go with page one, so that's our audit opinion. And then, so at the back of this report, you don't need to turn to it at the moment, but at the back of this report is a compliance report. It does disclose a finding for improvement needed in the closing process, and I'll cover that when I go over the management letter. Just to quickly mention the appropriations limit report, there's an option. So the appropriations limit report is a report that the board approves at the beginning of the year. Some people call it a spending limit. If you receive property taxes, you have to compute an appropriations limit to determine that your revenues that you appropriate aren't increasing faster than the population increase and income increases. So there was just a small difference in the beginning balance, and suggested using a higher population figure of the county as a whole, which increases that calculation a little bit. The amount, the limit is not that much higher than your revenue, so it's probably a good idea to keep it as high as possible. So we provided that just to you to consider on the next appropriations limit. If you continue on the financial statements, starting on page four is what's called management's discussion and analysis. It's an executive summary of what's in the financial statements. You'll see there's financial highlights. So keep scrolling down. There's some tables that show the changes in the balance sheet. There's some pie charts that show the components of revenues and expenses. So you can see the sale of electricity obviously is your biggest revenue source. You go down to the next table, your expenses. Oh, I'm sorry, that's another year of sale of electricity than the prior year. There's your expenses. So these give you a graphic image of what your revenues and expenses are that are in the financial statements. Now I'd like to move on to the balance sheet and income statement, page 13 of the financial statements. So if you review that MD&A, it'll give you a good overview of what happened during the year. So Steve puts that together and it gives you a good highlight of what happened. So here's the statement of net position, also called balance sheet. The cash and cash equivalents declined, as well as accounts receivable. That offset, there was a net loss due to the lower power sales during the year. So there was a $9.9 million reduction in power sales that made cash go down. It was offset by collecting those receivables, about $2 million of receivables collected. You continue to the next page. This page shows a fairly large increase in the debt OPEB liability, the post-retirement health care benefits is what the OPEB liability represents. It went from 15.8 to 18.2 million. That's because hasn't been funded. There's no trust or assets in it that are funding that liability, and so it's just growing. The district does have some assets set aside in a reserve, and those show up in a footnote later on in the financial statements, but because those assets are not in the trust, they're not considered to be plan assets, and it doesn't reduce that liability. So most of our clients are funding that liability. The actuary typically says how much it would take to fund the liability over the service life of the employees, and most of our clients are contributing to a trust these days. It's something to consider. If we look towards the bottom of the statement of net position in the net position area, you'll see that the unrestricted net position, I always turn to that number, that's the spendable net position, the spendable equity. You see there's $11.3 million down from $14.7 million. That reflects that loss that was incurred during the year. Although
I would point out that the Government Finance Officers Association recommends a minimum of about 15% of expenses in reserve. That's a very minimum. It could be as much as a year's worth, depending on what you have in the way of large projects going on. Right at the end of 2020, it was about 65%. So that's actually pretty good considering the year you had the lower power sales. They have about 65% of operating and non-operating expenses, which is the debt payment, less the depreciation. So that's pretty good. You could stop paying in, or you stop spending, stop doing capital projects and just pay your operating expenses if you had a really hard economic time. So that's a pretty good cushion to have. Not all entities are in that situation. So if you go to the next page, the change in net position on page 15, towards the bottom there, you see it was change in net position in 2019 was a positive $5.4 million. And you had good revenues. But those lower power revenues was a loss of $3.8 million. If you look towards the revenues and expense section just up a little bit, you can see that components of that. Obviously, the lower power sales really contributed. The expenses, not including depreciation, were down $649,000. The other major change towards the bottom there was there's some capital grants. And those were received for the MRC panel 300 road repair project. So moving on to the footnotes. If you have any questions, if you'd like to stop, just stop me and I'll pause on the particular page you have interest in. Now I'll go on to the footnotes. So the footnotes start at page 18. They disclose all the accounting standards or standards that are used, all the accounting principles that are used, how amounts are computed. You keep scrolling through. Towards the end of this section, there's on page 21 to 23, there's a description of new accounting standards. There was one accounting standard that was implemented, GASP statement number 88, which required us to disclose default provisions on the debt. A little farther there, there's what the accounting standards are. Not a whole lot out there that is really going to affect the district significantly. So we did implement certain disclosures related to debt during 2020. If you continue to the long-term liability footnotes, so because you have lower page starts on page 30. There it is. That's the beginning of the long-term liability footnote. Just had some pay downs during the year. You go to the next page. There's a footnote that describes your debt service coverage ratios below this table. And does show that the debt service coverage ratio was not met. So because of those lower power sales, the debt service coverage ratio requirement, and there's a page farther back in the financial statements that shows the actual computation of it. But it shows that the debt service coverage ratio actual was 17% and it needs to be 125%. So that's a result of those lower power sales. It says in this footnote, we talked to Steve about it, and we haven't heard of any, you don't meet your debt service coverage ratios, potential consequences of the bondholders call the bond due. We're not aware of anything of that nature happening. So it does say that. If you continue on with the footnotes, starting on page 33. Oh, just pause for a second on the next position or the fund balance that's going to go up. But so there's your reserves. Retirement, which you have 3.6 million in reserves set aside. That was the number I was saying. It's not considered to be OPEB plan asset. It's not considered to be part of your post-retirement health care benefit plan assets because it's not in the trust. That was strictly for employees. You do have access to that number. So that's the benefit of doing it the way the district has done. There is an emergency fitness act, not in the trust. And you also have designated for the Northview the water district agreement that rolls up for the total unrestricted position. So that's a $82 million reserve. It wasn't fully funded, but the unrestricted net position was high enough to fund that full $18 million reserve. Okay, so starting just below there is the pension plan. This pension plan footnote has lots of information about how your pension liability is computed. I'm not going to go into that in detail, but if you're interested in how it's computed, I'd like to scroll through that. The next one after that one is the post-retirement health care benefits, what we call OPEB benefits footnote. So that also shows all of the next little pension plan footnote. And then the following one is the post-retirement health care benefit footnote. There we go. So this is showing all your assumptions that are used to compute the liability. And the next one is your post-retirement health care benefit, same information related to that plan. Continue on. So lots of information related to your post-retirement health care benefits and pension plan and these footnotes. It takes a lot of time to prepare these footnotes. I'm going to keep scrolling down to page 41 and 42. I just wanted to mention that we did have some information in the financial statements about the North Cuba agreement. And right there, there's the very last paragraph below or above economic dependency. You mentioned that there is a lawsuit related to North Cuba where they claim that they are owed $2.2 million related to 2019. There's another footnote on page 42 that explains how it works. Well, it's disclosed in the financial statements. We looked at the computation that Steve prepared. It didn't appear that anything was due at the end of 2020 or 19 the way he computed it. The one thing that the agreement is pretty lean on details about how those amounts should be computed, right? The way Steve computed it, it didn't seem like there was anything new. So following the footnotes, have required supplementary information related to the post-retirement health care benefits plan and the pension plan. I'm going to keep scrolling down. One number I'd like to point out to you. So I'll stop on this page. This is the retirement plan page, and you'll see there's the top table. Shows the last percentage in the top table. It shows 81.64%. That's the funded percentage of the plan. So this table will eventually show 10 years of information. There was a standard that was implemented in 2014, so that's the first year in this table. You'll see that the funded percentage has been as low as 74%, as high as 83%. This is computed as of June 30, 2020. In 2021, pretty good investment here, so that possibly could go up, although I think they're reducing the discount rate, which increases the liability a little bit. They present value with a smaller discount rate, but that's a fairly decent funded percentage considering where it's been at some points in the past. If you continue past this, the next one is the post-retirement health care benefits. It doesn't have any funded percentage because there's no planned assets in that fund. And
Then the next table is the combining budget unit table. It shows the different budget units in the financial statements, and they are all combined in two. There's a general plan, and there's a joint use facility, general fund and joint use facility fund. Those are going to be the two left going forward. Of course, the joint use facility fund is the one used for the North Yuba agreement. The general fund is going to be everything else. So there were some transfers to move anything that was in those other columns into those two funds during 2020. So those will be the two that carry forward in the future. And the next page is the debt service coverage ratio that I mentioned. Oh, sorry, yeah, continue past these combining pages.
All the way to 55.
At the budget level.
55? 55.
There you go. That page right. Oh, I'm sorry, one more. Keep going. Lots of combining pages. There's the coverage ratio that I was mentioning. So, been pretty good in the past. In 2019, it was 4.36% with a 1.25% requirement. In 2020, it was at 0.17%. So, that's all I wanted to point out in the financial statements. What follows this table is the compliance report. It does say that there were quite a few adjustments that we posted during the audit. We'd like to see that cleaned up a little bit. It was a little better than it was in the prior year, so that's a little bit of a positive change. And then also after the audit was over, spent some time with Steve, making sure all of our adjustments were posted so we don't have any issues with the fund balance and net position rolling forward like we did in the past couple of audits. So I think that's good progress. The next, somebody want to stop me?
I think we're good.
Okay, so the next two items I wanted to talk about were the management letter and the governance letter. So the management letter did mention that the closing process needed improvements. We also had a couple of other recommendations. One was on inventory controls. There's no requisition process for inventory items in the power division, so that's often used to keep track of what's being pulled from inventory, to keep track of it. We have a recommendation about that. We had a recommendation about capital assets, cleaning up some of the capital assets so they're easier to deal with during the audit, writing off amounts below the capitalization threshold of 5,000. Combining some of the accounts. We had a recommendation about making sure net position rolls forward from the prior audit. We've done some work after the audit was over to make sure that that's going to happen this year. And we found there was a in our cash disbursements test control, there was one invoice that was missing the sign-off by the reviewer. Management said that invoice was reviewed, but that's something that we'd like to see. We'd like to make sure all controls are documented. We want to see the two people who are involved in controls. We want to see the preparer and the reviewer both sign off on the documents to make sure we can tell that two people were involved in reviewing. When things happen that are unexpected, it's because one person can do all of complete all the steps in the process and take a transaction from start to finish and take the money and then hide the money with the loss of an interest. So we don't want to see that. We want to see that all controls are documented. I'm not saying that that's happening, but that's why you want documents signed by reviewers. You want to be able to see that there's documented controls. We also recommended that someone review journal entries that Steve prepares. You know, that's a way that inappropriate transactions are often hidden is with journal entries. So we'd like to see a second review of that. If Steve is actually posting those,
would like to see a second reviewer. If someone else posts those, then Steve could be the reviewer. On the governance letter, one of the disclosures is what's estimated in the financial statements. So the qualifying expenses used to claim under grants, those are considered estimated because the grantor can audit those and determine some are not qualified after the fact. So that's an estimate until their audit period is over. The depreciable lives are estimates, and the pension and post-retirement health care benefit liabilities, those are estimates based on actuarial valuations. So there are 35 audit adjustments and closing entries during the audit. That's results in auditing the moving target. So that's something we talked about with Steve, that we'd like to see that number released in the future. And I don't know if Steve won't admit it, but maybe he might need a little bit of high-level help during the closing process to make that easier. It's an awful lot of work to do an audit and trying to do your day-to-day activities, report to the board, and take on the hundreds of hours it takes to get through an audit. That's a lot of extra work. So, I would recommend maybe getting some high-level help just in the closing process, at least to prepare for an audit. The governance letter also just has a table of tasks that's called unadjusted audit differences. So those are the differences that probably should have been posted, some entries that should have been posted that were not, that are considered immaterial. We got to the point where we're trying to finish the financial statements. We found some other immaterial differences. It's okay not to post those if they're considered immaterial, but we have to show all of those combined to make sure that they're immaterial combined, and they were the total effect on the net income was less than 2% of all those unadjusted differences, so we consider those to be immaterial. So that's my presentation. Happy to answer any questions or go back over anything you'd like me to.
Any questions?
In terms of the board, the two of you that are on the Budget and Finance Committee for fiscal year 2022, there are a handful of items that we will discuss in more detail, make some organizational adjustments or proposals to you for consideration at budget time, which starts in October, as far as the planning process.
Steve, did you have anything you want to add?
I just appreciate Brian's summary of the whole report, and again, my appreciation to all the staff that participated and helped with financial activities throughout the whole year. Hopefully there was nothing new that has not been communicated to you before over these past few months that Brian was sharing. It was a tough year, 2020, financially. I think you know that, but now others will know that as well. So it's important we take actions, even starting with this board meeting, and you will, or at least I assume we will, to address some of those revenue issues moving forward. So looking forward to that. This will be an interesting year as well as we continue we finish up our 2021 numbers as well. Sensitive to what Brian was sharing in terms of how we're getting our work done and accomplished, we want to be responsive with that, and so have plans to do that even as we prepare for this next budget cycle, and you'll be part of that as well as we work our way into those solutions. But be happy to answer any questions as well.
Ray, did you want to add anything?
No.
Okay. All right. Thank you, Brian.
If I could just have the
explanatory motion. Yeah. Okay. I move acceptance of the independent auditor's report and financial statements for the year ending December 31st, 2020 and 2019. Got a second?
I'm sorry, I didn't catch the second.
Todd, who's the second?
Thank you.
Any questions out there? And
nothing received in the email as of 2:31 p.m.
Okay. Let me remind those on the phone to press star 9 if you'd like to raise your hand.
No. Okay. All in favor?
Aye.
Aye. We have 4 ayes.
Thank you, Steve.
Thank you. Thank you. All right. Let's move into approval of minutes. Questions about the minutes from last meeting?
Thank you. Good afternoon to you all again, board members. Real quickly, for our August checks paid, payments made, on page 1 of 6, I'll highlight a payment to Badger Meter right in the middle. Check number 60598, Badger Meter. 1.5-inch turbo meters. That's actually for 2 of them, although obviously one is, that means they're both pretty expensive. So just information on that. We have a number of payments this month which are designated with, in the account column, project code 2021-0205. Those are expenses all related to the Highway 162 Audible Avenue project and included in general manager staff report, but those are records of the payments made in August. Of course, that's when the work was done. Jamie, if I could call on Jamie for still on page 1, check number 60601, a payment to Department of Public Health, a Butte County Department of Public Health.
So this is our annual fee for inventory that is held for hazardous materials, so in things like the petroleum oils, varying things for the various locations, and then also hazardous waste generation, so it's really a tiered amount plus other oversight consistent fees year-over-year as well. This actually represents 7 locations throughout the agency in both general fund and JFAW. So just want to make highlight that while it shows account 0762-625-01, obviously the PO is going to go to its respective account depending on which location is being charged. So it is an increase from year-over-year as we continue to see. And part of that was a Cal EPA increase on the environmental side and their oversight fee about double.
I wonder what color.
Yeah, but it definitely did go up. So just from a 2019 standpoint, we were paying about $4,300. In 2020, that jumped to $5,252. And then in 2021's invoice, it'll get us through 2022. That's $6,329 that you see today.
We're on a 3-year inspection cycle, Jamie?
Roughly, yeah. I would say COVID is hampered that a bit, but on average, that's what we need to see. That's great.
Got to watch these agencies. A lot of agencies have increased to a 2-year cycle strictly to increase fees. So thankfully, Butte County is not doing that as of yet, but a strategy to be leery and watch out for, and adamantly, you know, defend against if they try to do that.
And I think it was, you know, last year we spoke about, obviously we want to maintain as low of an inventory threshold as possible, not only from the environmental standpoint, but obviously, you know, only holding anything more than we have to from the inventory standpoint and end up in a higher tier for annual inspections as well.
Are we paying on waste oil? Or is that exempt?
Currently, we do. Our waste oil could fall in the exemption because it is so controlled, and the fact that it's not even mechanic, the basic oil changes for our vehicle fleet, both force down, power division, and general fund water division. So there is opportunity to look at exemptions for the motor oil piece as well.
Thank you,
Jamie. Just one more comment from me at this point. Page 4 of 6, again in the middle of the page near check number 60719 was a payment to Butte LAFCO for annexation and sphere of influence fees, which will all be reimbursed. It was three annexations that we're processing there. So I just wanted to highlight that for you. And then really at this time, maybe Rafe, you can respond to
sure
a few. I think you wanted to highlight a few.
Sure. Page 2 of 6, a little over halfway down. Check number 60642. This is Van Ness Feldman. So these are pooled fees associated with the FERC 401 water quality certification challenge, which we prevailed in, as well as our participating partners in that. And there's still work on that process based on the 4D conditions through the U.S. Forest Service and other entities. So this group, I think there's about six of us in total that participate in the fees to try to preserve the integrity as our FERC licenses are being worked on the 401 water quality cert. Page 3 of 6, halfway down, check number 60678, AECOM USA. I spoke to this last month. Gave you a heads up that you'd be seeing another one in checks and warrants. This one's for a total of $10,708. Again, this is for the final construction report creation and submission to FERC. The package itself, that report is about 95% complete, maybe even closer to 100 as we sit here. The challenge we have now is working with FERC to get it uploaded so that they can continue their review. What do I mean by that? They work remotely, they're not in the office, they're requiring electronic uploads and no larger than 10 megabyte increments. The base report is 140 megabytes, and all of the supporting documentation required for the report is another 58 gigabytes. So you can imagine if we have to sit down and try to create naming convention and split that in 10 megabyte increments, it's a very large effort. So we're trying to work on a compromise to get that content to them in whole via CD somehow and work out how the reviewing entities can each be responsible for their part within FERC. So for us, the heavy cost should be coming to an end here as long as we don't have to break this thing down into 10 megabyte increments as requested by FERC. We'll keep you updated on that process.
And so from a technology standpoint, Ray, is their request reasonable with the 10 megabytes?
How hard can you help me with that?
10 megabytes is a pretty small amount. Most everything deals in gigabytes now, so, but even at a gigabyte limit, that's 58 transfers, so.
So that's not reasonable what they're requesting of us.
That's what it doesn't sound like from a technology standpoint. I have halted AECOM's efforts on breaking that down into smaller increments until we can try to get it resolved directly with the reporting entities at FERC before we move forward with that request. So, it would be less expensive for us to carrier, you know, to someone's location in San Francisco to start the review. So. We'll still work on it, but I just want to give you a status update of where we're at with that project. Majority of that work product is complete. We just now have to get it to them for review.
So we're not done paying AECOM?
Correct. At least one more invoice.
So close.
Yep.
I feel like you're stringing me along on that.
I know.
I'm so ready for it to be done.
I tell you what, and that would make two of us, my second round. I have one more here. Page 406, almost all the way to the bottom. Check number 60731. This is to law firm. for professional services. You see that $37,778 there. It's worth highlighting again what that breakout looks like. The majority of that, $29,000 of that $37,000 ties to closed session items, whether it's Glades versus South Thunder Water Power Agency or the North Yuba Water District work, the CEQA suit, as well as the claimed breach of contract litigation. And so I'll a little bit tied into some sharp work as well there. And then the rest is really tied around general counsel support for both Water and Power Division and the 2020 water transfer efforts. But again, the goal, so when we talk about this, the goal is to minimize closed session items. That puts us in a manageable state. Those are my comments on checks and warrants.
Questions on the checks and warrants?
So the property insurance renewal.
Okay.
Right above A, comma, 3 of 6.
That's for the year. You can see that. Mm-hmm. And it's been less than $200,000 and more than $150,000 in the past, so I think we're still on the book in that same range.
And no issues with the policy. There's no, it's not like what's going on in the homeowners market. There's no.
Well, it's gone up, but you're right. At least we can get it. and they've communicated, Aqua JPIA has communicated with us that yes, there are significant changes in that whole liability marketplace. And to be prepared in coming years. As of next year, right?
So what does that mean? Like to the severity that homeowners are now experiencing?
No,
that
they haven't,
kind of prepared,
they haven't talked that. Just significant increases, 10 to 20%, if I recall that discussion. But still available to us.
I can see that. You know, remember, that's a pooled program, right? Correct, Steve?
Correct.
And yeah. So I can see, you know, continued wildfires, if that does not get under control, and other participating districts that sustain damage greater than any of us have had historically, that could be a real challenge, similar to private homeowner policies, et cetera. I think the difference is it would not be canceled, but certainly it would be made up for in premiums. And then on one other comment, on our safety performance, we'll receive a credit each year. Is that netted against this line, or is that separate from it? For a different policy?
It is, you're asking, that's actually shows up on the revenue side of our.
Right, but is it netted against this annual expense, or is there a secondary Aqua JPI expense that is netted against?
Financial data, do you, because it's all pooled together, so when we get that back, typically in April, which line item does that go back against?
And again, we show it on the revenue side completely.
Understood. I'll work with you offline, but I think what would be good to present to the board is to show when we receive those annual credits back, we compare that netted against what our payments were for that particular fiscal year to show what our true annual expense was associated with that credit on the revenue line. Does it make sense? When we're getting $15,000, $20,000 checks presented, let's demonstrate what our actual cash outlay expenses to Aqua JPIA year over year.
Fair enough, yeah.
We did just have a representative here in July to go over, and some of those very transparent, borderline uncomfortable questions were asked in terms of recognizing particularly what the infrastructure was exposed to during last year's North Complex. Obviously, they were pretty astounded that the agency was able to minimize the damage, and you know, so a lot of those very direct questions, even to such a point of, did you guys not file a claim because you were concerned about premium increase, cancellation, those types of things? Obviously, we had presented to you guys a year ago while that fire was still burning that we and the infrastructure had, basically just kind of. The border of the fire and the perimeter, definitely worked against our infrastructure, but we did get away pretty lucky up to this point with what we ended up being exposed to in terms of damages. But they did have a representative here to review all of the elements of our insurance just back in July.
And roughly out of that $190,000, how much of that is for the fire exposure risk component?
So our property total is roughly $114 million, Steve, roughly, in terms of total protection and in the event of our property schedule has a value of approximately $114 million.
Okay, and out of this premium, how much of that $190,000 is going for the fire component of our premium, just roughly?
It's not broken down in any personal line of insurance. So okay. They're looking at total pooled amount in terms of exposure to infrastructure, and then it's a property schedule for each respective location. Penstocks, powerhouses, IT, SCADA networks, those types of things.
Okay, because in theory, that component is the only one that we're really having increased risk with. Right, it's the fire component.
Currently, yes.
Yeah. And even in a commercial policy, a business policy, that would be broken out. So if that goes, you know, through the roof, it's just that component.
Right.
But we don't have that kind of a breakdown, apparently.
And the other element that would probably not normally been mentioned in the Miners Ranch Canal as well, Steve, is a new add into this year's property that
covered.
We were able to secure for
covered.
The first time. Mm-hmm. So that's a full year of transition of being able to have the Miners Ranch Canal insured, which was previously not the case, hence the reliability of FEMA process and things in the past. And damages due to erosion, 2017 storms, 2019 storms, that was an asset that had not previously been supported with property insurance.
Yeah, we were at risk.
That's true.
That we have seen in the past 3 to 5 years, not just fire as well. I mean, we've had a fair amount of damage as a result of, again, the 2017-2019 winter storms as well.
Thank you.
And we do have business interruption coverage as well. So, and it's included in your arm out here.
Any other questions?
Then let me just comment before the approval of the resolution. The $2 million requested for, which is really this month, the transfer is a little more than usual. I just this week have taken care of our debt service obligations, which are due October 1st. So that's that was a $1.3 million cash flow hit this month.
I move approval of expenditures for the month of August 2021 in the amount of $1,569,954.25 and authorize a transfer of $2 million from the TCB General Fund to the TCB Accounts Payable and Payroll Fund for the payment of regular operating expenses.
All right, first, we got a second. Any questions out there?
Nothing received in the inbox as of 2:50 p.m.
Okay. No motion for one. All in favor?
Aye.
Aye. Four ayes. Thank you, Steve.
You're welcome.
Keep standing.
Can I just get this thing
turned?
I know. It will be.
Let me quickly go through my monthly board report with you folks. I've included a paragraph on investment activity. Strange things are happening in the fixed income world. And there's a lot of movement going on. This paragraph summarizes there were actually a couple calls. That means the CDs or the notes were reimbursed or eliminated, called early prior to their scheduled maturities. That happens, but not nearly to the tune of one or two a month. It's usually one every 2 or 3 months or 4 months even. So there's a little more activity going on. Just tried to highlight that for you. Rates continue to be incredibly low, for a historically low, as you're probably aware of. I'll try and get this language incorporated into my monthly investment schedule, just so we can keep track of how those dollars come and go. There was a State Water Resources Control Board survey that came out, and we respond to the to that. There's some money at the state level that is scheduled to be available for those customers who are in arrears with their water payments due to COVID or other economic difficulties. The survey was statewide. Our opportunities for getting reimbursement for these accounts and those dollars is now in process, but it's going to be a long time if we see anything at all. Their survey included questions about minimum amounts currently outstanding, and we were well below the threshold that they were asking about. So, but we filed the report, and we'll see what happens with it. Pleased to report, we did get a reimbursement from Berry Creek Community Services District following our reimbursement request submitted to FEMA for the North Complex Fire, which was last year, literally last year at this time. So that was reimbursement for our different assistance provided personnel and then even materials and supplies. We've pleased to report we're doing some training in the finance division team. Again, this is a little bit related to what Brian was talking about in the audit package. We're just doing as much cross training as we possibly can, and so we're partway through all of that. And then comment that we are starting work as of now, of course, on our next year's budget, the formal budget document. Got a note for finance committee members or directors, Wilburn and Director Hickman, for our finance committee. And then that will keep us on schedule for adoption by the board in its November meeting for a budget for 2022. Moving on to the actual financial, current financial pictures. On page one of my attachments, there's my monthly graph. Power sold by month, our record for August, or you can see our report for August. It's in red, and it was very, very good. Thank you, Dan. Between generation and pricing, so that better than we've seen in a long time, better record than what we've had experienced earlier this year. And it looks like, according to, again, Dan's preliminary report, September will be a healthy month as well in terms of revenue generation. So we're grateful for that. Or I'm grateful for that as well.
We're grateful for
that. Yeah, exactly. Exactly. The next page, we get our cumulative totals as we're tracking those. In August, you can see at least we've got some separation this year, 2021, from our lower years that we've been reporting. And again, September should help us out quite a bit with that approach. We've also provided, as usual, our standard financial reports. We are now, this includes activity through August, which would be about 67% of the year through 8 months out of the 12-month year. So if that helps you with regards to percentage of budget, that'll help you to track that. I'll call your attention to page six, just the bottom line, estimated all the way to the bottom. At this point, we're at $21.4 million. That's if everything comes in as I've got them estimated, that puts us about where we want to be. But we'll see. We've got a lot of activity to happen before the end of the year. And part of it, our way to get to that number is a lot of capital projects have been put on hold and are being deferred. And then the same thing is true on our general fund. What I just talked about was our joint facilities operating fund. Same thing is true in our general fund, pages 7 through 9. On page 9, you can see in the estimated The ending balance, 2021 estimated column, go all the way down. We're kind of basically right at where we're kind of thinking we would be in budget. We're sensitive to that. Again, same thing, we've dropped off a number of capital projects. That helps us to get there. But we, as we go through today's meeting and then at future meetings, we'll have to make sure we get that addressed one way or another. I think at that point, I've been up here enough, so.
But if I could make one quick comment, if you don't mind, on Steve's cover sheet, Berry Creek Community Services District, I'd really like to take a quick moment and thank you as board directors for your visibility and approach and agreement to ink a memorandum of understanding as a mutual aid to help these folks. This is a little water district that we knew nothing about. Wildfire event literally destroys their ability to serve water to their customers. You as a board said, let's go help them. We did that. We did that short order, replacing pipe, wellhead, water system. Environmental Health and Safety worked with them to teach them how to interface and walk through the FEMA, Cal OES process, etc. It's your vision to be able to support other water districts, because someday that might be us, right? So I just want to thank you for that. In return, the process worked. The money we spent as a district was then reimbursed within a time frame. Frankly, $25,000 to get them back online and have a pressurized system is not too bad. Small water district, so thank you.
Hey, Steve.
Thank you, Steve.
Thank you.
Okay. All right, Dan, looks like you're up.
All right. Good afternoon, directors.
Good afternoon.
Thanks for your time. Take a few minutes here to review the August, the Power Division report with you. So for starters here on the first page one, we just start off here stating that as of the end of last month, end of August, we had 79,000 acre feet of storage, and combined storage in our Little Grass Valley and Slide Creek reservoirs. Currently, the storage is at 68,000 acre feet, so we've come down 11,000. We're running the units, the generators more, while PGA is dispatching them more here as we're later in the year. So for August, the productivity on the units, that is the amount of watt hours that they produce, was almost 40% of their full capacity, which is good news. And then on the page two, the top, that table, again, the column there, available for generation hours, is excellent. There are 744 hours in the month of August, and the units were available, four units were available for all but 2 hours. And so I really can't ask for more from the crew that continue to safely and responsibly operate the project. We've seen more hours where the units are running at their full nameplate. We like to see the generators running at full nameplate. That is where the most amount of energy is extracted from the quantity of water. So then ISO pricing, so as Steve mentioned, the combination of the running the units considerably more and pricing had a very good result. So the pricing for August was between $60 and $65 a megawatt hour, and as compared to the average of about, you know, 30, high 30s to 40. So that was a significant improvement. As far as the maintenance on the units, all four powerhouses are fully operational. Forbes Town, we had a unscheduled repair on the exciter slip rings, brushes. Then Kelly, we replaced this pump and did some testing there whilst the unit was in operation. Typically our water pumps, well, they're all in pairs, so it allows us to remove one from service without taking the overall generator down out of operation. So as far as other project assets that the crew are working on, we continue to do repairs on these personnel crossings here over the Myers Ranch Canal, repairing access gates that have been damaged or vandalized. The crews continue to do inspections on the reservoirs, remove debris, logs, and material from the intake screens, from the reservoir surfaces. We've been continuing to do recoding of, for example, the Association 8 Ridge deck. That's a new deck that was replaced, so the crew coded that, and also continued to work on the various buildings, the various outstations throughout the project to recode the interior and exterior, and just clean things up and make them much more. The interior of the building is much brighter, so it's easier to see equipment and perform maintenance and operations. As far as electrical link and controls type work, the crews do their monthly standby generator checks and also communication system type checks. So on to projects. So one larger effort that's been going on here for some time is our energy delivery transition projects. And I just mentioned three here, and these are on schedule, in scope, in budget. So we have communication networks, that projects that we're doing to establish communications throughout between various assets such as powerhouses and other locations. We're replacing the ISO meters, the Cal ISO meters, and also replacing our control system SCADA software and hardware. The ISO meter and the SCADA replacement, these are will be taking place. The vendors will be on our sites in November, first couple of weeks, to perform their replacement work. I failed to mention just before that, just in the later part of next month, we will be doing our outage of the Sly Creek powerhouse. So then now, also with regards to projects, we have the Lost Creek Dam mid-level valve access. So crew are installing new metal walkways and platforms to access the valves and equipment. And then the Sly Creek powerhouse restroom is another project. It's not a very large project, but it's one area where a lot of snow can happen, and then kind of snows in the bathroom, which is an outdoor building kind of on the side of the powerhouse. So the crews are improving that access. Personnel section here, we continue to recruit, look for hiring a hydro civil engineer, and the description is given. I made a few revisions. There's one revision here to the reports and tables. Well, first of all, the one on page 4 is the one that you typically see and has the roll-up of all the reservoir storage through the year. And also, the lower half of that shows the accumulated watt-hours on the unit's production. Also shows energy revenues, so these are year-to-date values, calendar year-to-date. And as far as the energy revenue on the lower right, we are pleased to see the improvements there, and hopefully it'll continue over the next several months. The next page, page 5, is our reservoir storage that we have each month. And the red line, I'll keep the current, with each year, keep the current year in red to make it to stand out. And we can sure see the trend in storage here, can't we? And the drops in these lines now really are indicative of the generators being run more, which is good. The last page here really is one I was referring to as far as a significant change to the report. We decided to share with you a more meaningful Northern California, Northern Region precipitation report. This comes from DWR, CDEC, it's on their website, and it's showing us folks in the know call the Station 8 Index, which is comprised of 8 precip gauges throughout Northern California. The little picture there kind of shows all the various ones. So it's a very good, meaningful kind of average of values. And so we can see here the current, which is the 21 water year, toward the second from the bottom, 23.8 inches. And this calendar on the bottom here is water year, is the DWR water year from October to September. And then we can see also toward the top here, some select years, the 2017 water year at 94 inches, and then the average of 51.8. So that is the content of the report from the Power Division. I'd be happy to go over any questions.
Yeah, Dan, yeah. How is the recruiting going for the civil engineer?
Well, it's a little slow right now. We have a certain expectation around a work scope that we would like the person to support. So we may make a revision to that, perhaps. It's just kind of a tight job market, perhaps, in this area, in this sector.
How many applicants have you received?
About half a dozen, and maybe only one has been close to being qualified, so it's not a very big pool.
They're hard to find, man.
Say again?
They're hard to find.
Yeah, seems to be.
Yeah, they are.
I should have gone to our civil versus under Legist, but yeah, they're getting through it. So we're working on it.
Hopefully you'll get a good one.
Thanks.
Thank you, Dad, for your report. That's great. Thanks, man.
Thanks.
Hello, this is Donna Corson. I have a question about Dan Fuller.
Okay,
go ahead.
When he mentioned 68,000 of the acre feet that Fly Creek in the first part of his report. That's what he said.
So the combined storage, which is the sum or the combination of Little Grass Valley Reservoir and Sly Creek Reservoir, currently is at 68,000 acre feet.
And that's different than, it's down about 12,000 acres from last month, acre feet, sorry.
Right, so then the storage at the end of August was 79,000 acre feet. That is correct.
All right, thank you.
Sure, thank you.
Catherine Eager, please.
Hi. Again, just wanted to let you know that we're going to run through beneficial uses of all the components of our water rights on a monthly basis. If there's any other items that you folks would like to see included in this report, please let us know. Under power, as everybody knows, the drought impacts to hydropower operations are pretty significant throughout the west coast of the United States. Fortunately, our agency specifically was able to do pre-curtailment diversions into storage, and so we've not really had the impacts into our operation outside of things beyond our control, like pricing and the way that PG&E runs us. So that's one plus for us in this current situation. As far as dam safety, DSOD has three of their engineers coming to do inspections October 19th through the 21st. We'll run through, the maintenance foreman and myself will run through all nine of our dams Brian won't come to one of those, but the irrigation at Lake Wyandotte is something that DSOD inspects, even though it's not part of our FERC project. We're also working on annual reporting to FERC. We have a number of reports that still have to be submitted prior to the end of the year, and we've received our notice on our Part 12D inspection requirements to be completed before December of 2022. So we're working on an RFP to put that out to bid to secure a consultant for that. For domestic uses, water rights holders throughout the state were issued notification on enhanced reporting requirements on a monthly basis if they divert more than 5,000 acre feet a year. We fall into that category with all of our licenses. And Dustin, you can jump in with legalese if I get off track here. So September 10th, we were due to report all of our uses, all of our diversions from January through July, and then our proposed diversions for the next 3 months. So every month on the 10th through July of 2022, we will be required to report on the previous month's diversions and then a rolling 3 month prediction on diversions. So we'll be utilizing the 2020 data and then moving into 2021 data as we roll through the year to do those predictive uses. On, it's, you get bombarded with news on the drought. Fortunately, even within Butte County, even though the drought effects are pretty significant in our county, our agency is still being able to deliver all required supply for domestic and irrigation uses. We are prepared to submit our 2020 water loss audit validation on time this Friday. The consultant has wrapped up that process as of this morning, and so we'll be timely in submitting that report. Ray can expound a bit more on irrigation in his report, but that season is due to wrap up maybe depending on hydrologic conditions prior to our next meeting with you, but we can speak more to that. With regard to recreation, there was an update that was not included in the report. Forest Service didn't let us know until this week that they've actually closed Strawberry Campground. So that's something that I'd like to report out to the board and the public. The rec limit at Little Grass Valley Reservoir remains in place until Thursday, and then that number will fluctuate as it does on a monthly basis until we have any changes in hydrologic conditions. And if there's any other questions or any comments on content that you'd like to see in this report, just let me know.
I wonder if this report for the statewide drought update, this is the worst year in 127 years as far as the records go back?
As far as documenting on dry conditions, and there's a number of factors that go into that, as far as how crops are affected and water deliveries availability through the state and federal projects, and then just overall local impacts.
Yeah, we went on vacation to Crescent City this summer in July and August. The Smith River and the Klamath River, we've been going there many years, and my wife grew up there, 5 feet lower than normal. It's bad. It's bad.
Thanks, Kristen.
Thank you for your report.
So quick question on this. Probably Dustin is probably going to have my answer here. Dustin, is this legitimate, the curtailment order on pre-1914 water rights holders?
We will see. So let me take a step back, and then I'll try to answer your question more directly. But we in California have a priority system, which means in times of shortage, drought, you curtail in reverse order, priority starting with the least junior water rights and then rationing back until you have a scenario where available supply equals available demand or demand for water. So the priority system is something that we like. It's something that the state has used since statehood. So it provides certainty, and we want the state to implement the priority system. Where the rub is that this is a very complex analysis. It sounds simple. What's the supply? What's the demand? But when you get into a system as diverse and large as the Bay Delta watershed, it gets to be a very difficult technical issue to try to solve. So that's where I think much of the dispute is my vintage of pre-1914 water right legitimately curtailed because there's not available water supply, or because there's more senior folks downstream of me, or is the methodology they're using not defensible? So there are, at last count, there's four challenges to the Water Board's pre-14 curtailment regulations. All four of those lawsuits were filed by folks located south of the Delta, so San Joaquin River folks and some others. To my knowledge, there has not been a filing from a Northern California entity or water right holder yet, but this is the type of thing that I will be monitoring. It may be something that a group of clients or a coalition would like to intervene in, because again, we're in this dynamic where we don't want to push the state to something other than the priority system. We like the priority system; it provides certainty. That's what we understand. But yet, at the same time, we want them to do it in a technically defensible way. So we're kind of straddling that line there. Now, specific to South Feather, the curtailment doesn't affect you operationally. We're currently diverting from storage. We will continue to divert from storage. And previously stored water is, in effect, exempt from a curtailment order. So we can continue business as usual. We're doing the enhanced reporting and those types of things. We'll continue to do that. Where the concern lies with South Feather is in lifting the curtailment. And we've had Octobers where you can get 5 inches of rain, you can actually accrue storage. Hopefully that's the case. But October, November, December, whenever we start getting storm events, we need all curtailments lifted, not just pre-14, because we want to capture as much water as possible in anticipation that the drought could continue into 2022. So that's the issue that has my attention for South Feather. And we're working with water board staff to make, they're aware of this issue. We're not the only ones talking to them about lifting curtailments in a timely manner in advance of storm events. So, but I'll keep you posted on how that effort goes.
And this has been done before with pre-curtailment pre-1914? And if so, when was the last time? Was it done in the 70s, 76?
No. Not to my knowledge. There was some discussion during the last drought and probably in some areas legitimate grounds for curtailment, but it was not done. So this is a first. There has been some intervening litigation that was resolved in the Water Board's favor around emergency rulemaking and that's a this is getting into the weeds a little bit, but it's a legislative action rather than an adjudicatory action. And because it's legislative, from the Water Board's perspective, it's more legally defensible to go down the path of an emergency regulation, which is what they did with these curtailments. So as I said, there's 4 active cases. They'll proceed through the court system, and eventually the court will decide whether it's appropriate or not. But We're in a difficult kind of policy position of, on one hand, saying, yeah, we need to implement the priority system, and yet on the other hand, having some concerns about the defensibility of their technical analysis for their assessment of supply and demand. So that's where we're at.
Never a good thing when the State Water Board goes into new territory. That I recall, anyway.
Mm-hmm. Thank you. All right, let's do a quick overview of water divisions. So we'll start with domestic water treatment operations. You can see that our Miners Ranch treatment plant production was slightly down from the previous month. We produced a little over 259 million gallons. The same can be said for Bangor Treatment Plant. It was also slightly down at 1.1 million gallons. You can see the trended curve there. We are monitoring the Red Hawk Ranch water delivery system. At least we will for a while, make sure that continues to operate as planned. We did deliver approximately 1 million gallons since our last board meeting, so it's working well. And 2 new services were connected this month, and we have an additional planned service to be funded and connected in October as well. So that system is growing as well. All of our bacteriological requirements were good for the treatment facilities as well as the campgrounds. In light of Kristen's communication to you prior, we'll have a conversation internally around whether or not we need to do water draws for Strawberry for the balance of this recreation season or not. So we'll come to terms on that. If we don't need to do that, since it's closed, we certainly will not exhaust resources performing that or expenses. In terms of the irrigation season this year, again, all canals and ditches are in operations. As Kristen briefly mentioned, we will plan to end the irrigation season somewhere between October 15th and November 1st. We have a number of areas that we would like to get busy working on. That require the ditch system to be dry or close to dry in order to get in and make those repairs in anticipation of next year's season and continue improvements, as well as make sure we don't end up in some of the forecasted weather events that we see coming in October and November that could play a role in raising the elevation while we're delivering water through there. So we'll keep you informed of what that is, but I would expect by October's board meeting we will be close if we had not actually end of the irrigation season. We are also going to design and install an inline secondary mechanical filter system in the Bangor Canal by next irrigation season.
And so this is to assist with large land or objects and things that travel down that system and catch them before they actually reach the Bangor treatment plant, both for the raw water pump station going to Red Hawk Ranch, as well as water that feeds into the treatment plant. So it's basically a secondary containment system to make some continual improvements there. You can see the flows as they stand right now in the irrigation system. So SF14, which is the Upper Forbestown Ditch, has been pretty consistent, around 15 cubic feet per second. WD6, that's the Lower Forbestown Ditch, which we feed in to our customers, ultimately tails off into Lake Wyandotte. That's about 7.3. It's been as high as right at 8 and as low as 6.97 or 7. So it's fluctuating, averaging out about 7.3. You can see the other two. In terms of district-wide maintenance operations or repairs, again, we had heavy leak repair, and that's actually continued since publication of this report. We'll talk a bit about that between aging infrastructure and then our information item around water theft, what some of the contributing factors may be there, why we're having so many leak repairs to address. And you can also, though, see a positive note, 5 more new services were installed also during the month. We're continuing to grow our customer base with installation of new services, so happy to see that as well. In terms of the Highway 162 road widening project, last month I communicated that we'd completed that project. Since we met, Caltrans has reached out to us and communicated that their portion of the project to actually grind and change the elevations, repave that road, will now not start till next season. So as a result of that, South Feather and Pacific Gas Electric, for their contribution as well, we both have to go back out to that location, remove what we call cold patch asphalt, where we trenched and dug, and actually replace that with hot mix asphalt. We were able to get away with cold patch, had that project started here in October from that standpoint on the road. So what does that mean for South Feather? It means that we're going to have to hire traffic control for one night, and we will need to source for hot mix asphalt to go out there, take out the cold patch, put in the hot mix. That has not been easy. This is what I would consider a nuisance project for most asphalt. So we have one responsive bid so far to do that, which is at $10,700. And then you add one night's worth of traffic control, which could be $5,000. So we're probably at $16,000, maybe $17,000 to go do this, which was not planned as a result
of
this.
Right, here's another problem you got. It's getting colder at night. Asphalt's going to get colder. It's going to be harder to work. So when they haul it in, they're going to have to tarp their loads, and they get the closest hot plant you can. Hopefully the one here in Orville is up and running, but I don't know. Otherwise, it's Chico.
Yeah, so we'll work with OAS trying to get some more competitive bids other than no, we're not interested or we're too busy. So
who made the bid?
DNS. So, you know, the larger folks are too busy, and it's just considered just a nuisance to do a one-night job out there. So we'll keep searching, try to get someone before the weather does change and get that taken care of.
Well, the good news is it's not a top overlay coat, so if it's a little rough, they'll live through it, and then they'll repave it this summer.
Take your word for that, because I think our cold patch work is holding up pretty well right
now.
So. So it's not too bad, really, but anyways. And then my final comment on the staff report is the PG&E settlement agreement. The force majeure dispute has been finalized, and that matter is now concluded. Great. Thank you.
Question, Ray?
Yes, sir.
I have a friend who lives on Oakville Road, past Oakville School. He got the turbo ditch running along his property, and he's got probably 2 acres or so. He wanted to know if he could build a little storage pond and buy water out of that ditch or connect to it for future fire. So I told him I'd check it out and see what he has to do for procedures with you, maybe the county.
Yeah, what I would encourage you to do is have him first start with inquiring with South Feather staff on an application for service, so we can take a look and understand what he's requesting.
Yeah.
Off that ditch, there are what we call offshoots of that as well, to manage high water events. We also need to learn and understand what's near his property, his or her property, etc.
Yeah, when he noticed it was grown over with blackberries and brush for many years, he found an old existing
concrete little dam, and it needs to go down. But one thing you got all the way through every ditch, everywhere in this county and everywhere, overgrowth of brush. And if these county guys, especially with their work inmate crew, if they would get those guys out working and cleaning all these ditches, it'd make the water flow better for everybody, and it might help fires.
So recognize who's responsible for those ditches. That's South Feather.
No, that's not just South Feather. It's everybody.
Well, it's South Feather.
Look, every county, everywhere in this state that we can see.
Yeah.
Okay. So it'd be a good idea if the law enforcement people would start a bigger work inmate crew, even statewide. Put these people to work and teach them a trade instead of locking them up and paying them for nothing. I don't know how we could spearhead a drive to do that.
So we have historically worked with the New County Sheriff's Department on inmate crews, etc. That requires guidance, because we also need to manage what debris is removed and not removed, make sure it doesn't impact the integrity of the outer walls, the canals, etc. And so we'll continue to do that. I mean, we certainly are focused on the top of the canals and the sides. I will tell you that from a private property standpoint, so those properties that lead up to those canals, that's where our responsibility tends to stop, but we could certainly encourage that.
Did I say he rebuilt the whole place, and he's clearing all the brush out of that ditch so the water flow, and if he ever gets a fire, it won't be as bad. But if all the rest of the people would step up, take care of their property, it won't be so bad.
Yeah, I know what property you're referring to. We've actually had to speak with that individual, make sure to compromise the ditch. So that's why it's important to send them to us.
Right.
Okay?
Yeah.
Thank you.
Thank you.
So please direct them our way. Thank you, Director.
Any comments on closed session items from the audience?
Nothing online. Remind those on the phone to press *9 if you'd like to make a comment.
And nothing in the inbox as of 3:29 p.m.
Before we go into closed session, maybe just a discussion about process here, Art. I don't have a firm estimate of how long we'll need in closed session. Do you, Ray?
I do not, but I would say it's at least 30 minutes.
Yeah, I would agree. 30 minutes to an hour would be my guess. So for folks that want to rejoin...
What I'll do is I will move them into the waiting room.
Okay.
So they won't be able to hear anything.
And then when we're... Then whenever we'll get to Charles here in a moment, but whenever we come back in, you'll automatically move them back in.
Correct.
Okay.
Hello.
Go ahead, Charles.
Can I say something before you go into closed session?
Yes.
Okay. Good afternoon, Charles Sharp in Oregon House. The North Yuba Water District is now trying to make the argument that even though it is set up as an irrigation district, has been providing irrigation work for over 50 years, it is not actually an irrigation district, but only a water district. As such, it is not obligated to provide irrigation work. Without this obligation, the Water District can go to the State Water Resources Control Board and make the case that since the district has only 800 domestic customers, there is nobody to provide the 20,000 acre feet of water for an official use to, and the SWRCB should allow it to sell this water to the highest bidder it can find. Gentlemen, I would like to remind you that the lawsuits legally challenging the North Yuba Water District, and which provides for legal action such as depositions or a burdensome out-of-pocket expense for the private citizens trying to hold this rogue agency accountable. Also, I happen to have this hand-drawn flow diagram from 1953 showing the Arrow of Montecito very well. It's kind of hard to see, but it's from 1953 showing the vision of the Palo Water from the Little Creek, Little Bass, Grass Valley Basin, South Fork Basin, South Creek Basin, Slate Creek Basin, and Canyon Creek come together to fill the Little Grass Valley Reservoir and the Lost Creek Reservoir, and was going to provide water and power generation to the entire region. 68 years later, it is still a good plan. Thank you very much for your time.
Thank you, Charles. All right. So let's go ahead and move into closed session. Mr. Sharp, can you hear me?
Yes,
hello? No, I was just checking to see that if you were complete so we could go into closed session. Thank you.
Give me a moment as I move everyone into the waiting room. And we are line. And we're good.
So can I ask the question again? The direction was given to real property negotiators and legal counsel.
All right, directors, tab six, business item, is seeking approval to enter into a power purchase agreement with Northern California Power Agency. Art, would you pull up the presentation for me? Thank you. Let's go back one slide, thank you. So, this has been This journey on the hydro energy strategy, you've heard about it month over month, whether it's been Dan Leon's power division reports, or we've had information items, or in the general manager's report, etc. We had presentations in July from consulting support on this project. Thought it'd be worthwhile to just kind of go through from a slide deck standpoint where we were, where we're at, and then answer any questions you may have at this point with this product for the power purchase agreement and resolution. So if I may, let me go back. You've seen this at least two occasions over the last 2 years. This is a flow diagram of energy delivery in California. Again, this is through the California Independent System Operator. You hear us refer to it as CAISO on a regular basis. And so just a reminder of how the hydro energy is dispatched and then delivered onto the grid from a South Feather perspective. So the CAISO, they forecast demand on the transmission systems, and then there are companies, many companies, that go out and buy and sell that power before the market. That's called kind of a day-ahead market. So you're buying on the market, almost like commodities brokering. And so, like in our case, you know, we're putting in front of you a lot of work around NCPA, PG&E, our current contractual partner up until December of this year, same type of thing. But there's all these entities, and we'll have some farther examples as we go through. They buy and then sell this energy onto that grid. At that point, after the bids are processed, etc., then the congestion needs to be managed on the transmission lines through CAISO, and then they dispatch that energy for folks to actually produce, whether it's hydro or some other format of energy. And that's where South Feather comes in. So we receive a dispatch schedule. We generate, in our case, through hydropower. We generate that, and then we deliver it onto the grid. And that's through PG&E-owned transmission lines. And that is important, because when we're talking about a power purchase agreement here, we're requesting the board to consider moving with the expiration of the PG&E agreement to NCPA today, but that does not include transmission lines. The transmission lines are a separate interconnection agreement with PG&E, so PG&E continues to own, maintain those lines, and we generate energy and we sell it to whatever buyer through those transmission lines. That point, it then gets onto the transmission line and then distributed to dwellings, business entities, etc. So that's kind of the background of how that process works again for the third time. So I'm sorry to bore you with that, but just thought it might be a good reminder as we go into this slide content. So now let's talk about, big picture, our hydro energy strategy timeline.
I joined the agency in October of 2016. By 2017, a few months later, short some spillway failures and some other events, Power Division Manager and myself started working on a strategy knowing that we were going to near the end of a power purchase agreement with PG&E, and we needed to start early to understand that, to find out if we were going to have an opportunity to continue with PG&E, what do the market conditions look like, or are there other opportunities that are better aligned for South Feather. So we started that journey in 2017. It became obvious late in 2017 that we needed some outside consulting support. So in other words, experts in the industry. You met that group a couple months ago. And so we ended up engaging with GridsME for market and off-taker opportunities. So someone lives within the energy sector and market to open the doors for us to work not only with PG&E, but other potential buyers, et cetera, and understand the past market, the current market, and the future market the best we could. So from that time frame all the way through 2019, we had discussions and an analysis of potential PPA buyers, which included PG&E. So we had a whole host of those, which we'll talk about in a minute. And we started working through them, through solicitation efforts, et cetera, both formal and informal meetings. And if you recall, you've seen this slide many times. We looked at independent operating utilities, IOUs, that's where PG&E falls. We looked at municipal utilities, that's where an NCPA falls. We looked at community choice aggregates, and we also looked at direct access service providers. So we had a whole laundry list of possibilities to try to learn and determine what would be the best avenue for South Feather in the future, moving forward. So as we did that, we then spent portion of 2019 and all of 2020 narrowing that list of viable off-takers, you know, looking for what is that best match for South Feather. And so if you go back to this list again, who do we narrow that list down? So we narrowed down to folks like Three Phase Renewables, Shell Energy, and then we had some new players come along. So ones that we didn't initially identify came along through that process. So then we started engaging with East Bay Community Energy, San Jose Clean Energy, and they were becoming, you know, viable considerations as well. Also NCPA, and then the entire process did include PG&E through that process. I have that circled in yellow versus red because, as we've communicated in previous board meetings, PG&E shifted their energy purchase strategies internally, so they're no longer offering traditional power purchase agreements, so that was off the table, and they've moved towards resource adequacy procurement. And that model, and PG&E agreed as we worked through those details, just does not align with South Feather's financial needs to operate and maintain FERC licensing on the South Fork Power Project. So we both agree, that was kind of a two-way street, that that's not going to work for us. That doesn't say that PG&E sometime in the future would consider changing what that model is, but as it stands right now, it's a mismatch. So they became a yellow, not a green, as we narrowed down that viability list. So if you go back to where we stand today here in 2021, what do we know? We know that our PG&E PPA ends on December 18th of this year. And today, we're requesting you as board directors to consider approval of a resolution on a power purchase agreement with Northern California Power Agency that has an effectivity date of December 19th. So essentially, we would operate under the PG&E purchase agreement until midnight on December 18th at a 1201 convert to NCPA to have, in theory, a seamless transition, which sounds easy verbally. Ask Dan how easy and Art how easy that process is from a communication technology standpoint. So we're hoping it is underwhelming, like one flip of the switch and everything's good, but it's a lot of work in between now and then. So let's talk about NCPA a little bit specifically on hydro revenue valuation. So again, as we've communicated in the past, this model that we're proposing to you in the power purchase agreement is a fixed plus variable pricing. So under the current PG&E agreement, the only known that we have is a guaranteed of approximately $357,000 a month. That's all we know.
All the rest of the revenue generated off that project is based on how we're dispatched, what our utilization is of those assets. With this model with NCPA, we've worked very hard on this. That changes that number by about 3.5 times. So it increases between 3 and 3.5 times that amount of 357. So we now have a baseline number that we know that is literally a planned income throughout the year that we can budget to, that's better than just assuming historical run rates. We kind of have, we know where it's at. In terms of the term of the agreement, it's written where it's an initial 10-year with a built-in option for 20 years. I think NCPA would prefer a longer 20-year plan. You know, that's a long time, so that's why we've built in this option that around year 9 needs to be discussions about continuation or not, if you go beyond the 10 years or not with the agreement. What it does assume in terms of revenue valuation is what it means, and you're going to see some numbers in a moment here, but it assumes that we, South Feather, operationally maintain our utilization, in other words, uptime and availability of the project at 95% minus our planned maintenance outages. So every year we have planned outages that pulls those out. So beyond the planned outages, the pressure for us to maintain what we believe our revenue deliverables could be through the project, that we keep our assets running. You know, that's the conveyance system, that's the hydropower plants themselves, et cetera, 95%. Our, on average, uptime has exceeded 98% year over year, in case you were to ask that question, how does that compare to what historicals are? So we have room there.
Great. Are you talking about just the ability to run?
Or ability to dispatch and deliver.
Okay, yes. So we're not saying we're just going to be running 95% of the time, we're just saying that it would be
available to run when needed. Right. So, in other words, unplanned outages need to be minimized. We need to be ready to go. The car is in idle, just ready to shift to gear. So the revenue range with this valuation within CPA is somewhere between $14 and $24 million annually, and I will explain that in some upcoming slides. And on an extreme wet year, and I've put some parentheses there, saying that on an extreme wet year, we have the ability to deliver something greater than, say, 580,000 megawatt hours of energy, we could be in excess of $28 million on a year like that with this proposal. I will tell you, that's rare. So a greater than 580,000 megawatt year is probably once every 8 to 10 type thing. So for sake of trying to give you clarity on what this looks like compared to our PG&E PPA, what I've done here is created a predictability curve, and this is based on historical actuals. So I've taken 2011 through 2021, and 2021 is obviously a forecast. We still have one quarter to go as we stand here. And I know it's a little bit hard to read before I start plugging in, but what you'll see is, for example, in 2011, we earned or delivered $21 million worth of revenue from our assets. So PG&E compensated us $21 million. If in 2011 we were operating off of this agreement in front of you today, that would have been $26.9 million. And then if you look to the right, 2018, and I'll explain why I've kind of skipped as you go across these curves. 2018, the same thing. We received $13.2 million. If we were operating under this agreement that you have in front of you, that would have been $17.3 million. And then this year, as we stand here right now, we have a forecast of about $10.5 million. With NCPA, that would have been $14.9 million. So about a 22% increase, just baseline increase, on the differences in the negotiations of a power purchase agreement. Now, to add a little bit more clarity to that, if you look at this year, you know, we're going to be close to about 192,000 megawatt hours, maybe slightly below that, but that's kind of the baseline where we expect to be. So that's what we consider low end. That's a drought type year, less water availability, less production through the project, but still, you know, a $4.4 million increase on a low year. Anything below 192, we're in trouble from a water standpoint. Otherwise, we're delivering at that or above. Oops, my apologies. 2018 is what we would consider more of an average or a typical year from a hydrology standpoint. 272,000 megawatt hours or so is what we delivered there. That was 13.2.
It'd be 17.3. That's what you typically expect. We're going to be in that 272, 300, 350 type range year over year. And if you start to get into your better water years, you can see here in 2011, that was a 574,000 megawatt hour year, hence why those revenue numbers were higher. So we get into years like that. We have the water ability to deliver. We could expect, you know, 27 million plus, as long as the water's there, the fuel is there to run the project. Does that make sense? Yeah. I try to figure out a way to give you some sort of predictability of what that would look like with this agreement. So, you know, why NCPA? You know, we believe that we have aligned long-term interests. Their members are very interested in our project, and we're very interested in working with those members and at the same time maximizing our revenue possibilities. It does provide South Feather that financial certainty that I discussed a little bit ago. So we now have a new baseline that's something north of 357 per month. Schedule coordination, that's a big part and a requirement of any type of project like this. And schedule coordination is also with the same entity, NCPA. So our off-taker is also our scheduling coordinator. This is important because with many of the others we looked at as we were trying to shortlist, etc., most don't offer schedule coordination. The cost to do that or to source that to an outside entity runs between $500,000 and $600,000 in today's pricing market. And if you were to invest to do that internally, you're north of $2 million to put that type of organization together. So that schedule coordination is built into this agreement where there are no costs. It's built in as part of this power purchase agreement where NCPA would be the schedule coordinator for our project. NCPA is very experienced in optimizing hydro in the CAISO market. They're very, very good at what they do, so we think that's a real advantage going with that group versus someone that's less seasoned in that industry. And then the operations center and their headquarters are local to South Feather. So what do we mean local? So their primary headquarters and operating center are in Roseville, and then they have disaster recovery and backup currently in Citrus Heights. So if we run into an issue or something that needs to be addressed in the project, we're an hour and 15 minutes away from being face-to-face solving whatever that topic may be. So very fast response times from that standpoint. And then NCPA is a member agency. They're nonprofit, so you know they're a member agency, so they're stable and predictable as a municipal utility, and their member base is really sound. So that's why we believe that this group is an important alignment with South Feather. They're cooperative, they're collaborative. You've heard this in the past, as we've been working through this over the last 3 years. So really, to summarize from a presentation standpoint before we go into the board packet content, staff and I firmly believe, we've been presenting this to you for a while, that the South Feather NCPA does result in a long-term viable partnership. It's good for NCPA and it's good for South Feather.
Very good.
So does that help with kind of the background again one more time where we've gotten here for this tab? So if you go to the business tab, you have two things in front of you. You have the power purchase agreement. There are some sections that are shadowed out. There are some areas around the calculation of funding and payments, etc., that are shadowed out until we receive, you know, mutual approval. So assuming that you as a board approve this power purchase agreement and that NCPA approves the power purchase agreement, then those types of areas of the financial contract price, base up with those things, would then become mutually viewable upon agreement from NCPA. If you go back into the appendix, however, the appendixes A, B, C, etc., those are interconnection schematics and critical infrastructure. Those would continue to not be publicly viewable because that could impact the ability to cause harm to the infrastructure under the Critical Infrastructure Act. So that's what you have in front of you. And then with help of general counsel, we have drafted language for a formal resolution, and that's what we're asking for your consideration today after questions.
is approval of resolution 21-28-09 to enter into this power purchase agreement with Northern California Power Agency.
Sounds good. Any questions?
Yeah, I got a what-if. What if South Bend decided to add more power generators?
Excellent question, Director Moreland. So early on, so this was actually back in probably, I would say, early to mid-2019, we asked those very questions as we were going through the vetting process. And NCPA said that they would incorporate and accept any and all additional energy that we could deliver. And for my mind, that could be hydro assets. At one time, we had one in particular that was kind of on the table that could have possibly been divested from one entity that we may be of interest in. So we did go through that process. And then the other thought in the future is additional storage opportunities, right? I don't know if that's batteries or if it's some other type, but South Feather, you as a board, we may be coming to you, throwing out opportunities for energy storage and delivery to that grid. And NCPA would also be interested in procuring.
You might be able to put one on a little grass and maybe one on a pot of roses.
Yep. It's a great, insightful question, and we did not want to limit ourselves in the ability to offer that, expand the portfolio.
Or in the future, you got a lot of property, you may build a big solar farm.
Yeah, it could be any number of things if it makes sense. You know,
it's all been covered and ready to go.
Yep. Would you concur, Dan?
Yes.
Perfect.
What would happen in 3 years? We had a problem with PG&E with using their power lines.
So the transmission lines? Yeah, so we have those interconnection agreements, and so if PG&E was to violate something in those agreements, we'd have to address that. There's actually liability protections and mechanisms in here for both NCPA and South Feather in those scenarios. We have walked through some what-ifs and some hypotheticals with NCPA on that. And they've agreed that they would work with us. That's kind of something outside the control of South Feather. It's not negligence on our part. So we'd work through how to manage that if that was to occur.
The template language that, because there's many of these IA agreements out there, the template language requires PG&E. I think it's a best effort standard. You know, what comes to my mind is there's some large fire event, destroys the lines. How could we incentivize PG&E to get up and running and repair those damaged lines as quickly as possible? That was the concern. And there's contract language in those IA agreements that require PG&E to utilize its best efforts to rebuild their transmission system.
Yeah, there is talk they're going to bury, 10,000 miles of power lines?
That's right.
And that'll create a lot of jobs.
Yep.
Looking good.
They're doing that, like, they're going right now, very quick.
Are they burying it? Makes sense. You got to rebuild, you might as well go in there.
They're doing all of Paradise.
Yeah. How come they don't include Stearns Road water storage lake with that?
I think that's outside the gambit of undergrounding power.
Yeah. But PID should pick it up.
Good questions. Other questions specific to the content?
All right.
I move to approve resolution 21-28-09, approving the general manager to execute power purchase agreement with Northern California Power Agency effective December 19, 2021.
I'll second that.
Okay, a second.
Yeah, well done, guys.
Any questions from the audience?
Nothing online.
Nothing received in the inbox as of 4:43 p.m.
All right. All in favor?
Aye.
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 Four ayes.
Thank you, directors. This has been a long time in the works. I want to thank staff. This has been countless hours with Dan and others.
Your laptop and what you came up with.
Yeah.
And it's exciting.
And so this is a big shift right here. We're far from done. We've got, 27 days and counting. What's the number of days?
We have got a lot of ones to count.
Go.
Days to December 18th.
So for all the connections. But thank you.
Thank you.
Thanks.
Good job, guys.
Mr. President, there's a message. Ms. Bernay was just saying congratulations.
Oh, thank you.
Thank you.
That was the entirety of tab 6, correct?
Yes.
Yeah.
All right, let's move on to tab 7.
Tab 7 would have been a lot more exciting if tab 6 hadn't become before it.
Yeah,
I mean, a power purchase agreement is a tough act to follow.
You got this pretty little masterful job. I'm impressed.
All the same, we're really excited to be able to present this to you directors today. The potential to authorize the general manager to sign an MOU with Butte County in order for us to move forward on the seeking of funds and the project implementation for the consolidation effort to provide treated water service to the Palermo community. So today we're asking that in support of the materials presented to you, the MOU that is also going before the Butte County Board of Supervisors today, that you would authorize Rafe to sign that MOU. Also on the Butte County Board of Supervisors agenda today is the funding of an additional contract with Ludorf Scalmanini Engineering Contractors for the purpose of preparing the two latter components of a drinking water state revolving fund grant application. They've already, out of their initial technical assistance grant funds, have put together the general application and the financial component and submitted that. Related to that effort, the consulting team, the county, and South Feather had an initial conversation with State Water Board staff last week, so that rather than just submitting the application through the data portal, that we would have, you know, face-to-face conversation via Zoom with them to explain the particulars of the project. One of their questions that we needed to provide documentation back to them is how many second homes and vacation rentals are available in Palermo. So we have a little bit of homework to just clarify. Well, we purported none, but you know, we could find otherwise.
It's very unique out there.
Disadvantage or severely disadvantaged community status, they really want some further supporting documentation. Obviously, they've had experience with that coming through in the application process before. So we have some clarifying information to provide to them. The county is working on providing those items. But in all likelihood, the Board of Supervisors will authorize county funds to expand the scope of their technical contract with Ludorf Scalmanini in order for them to prepare the project engineering and environmental components to a percent complete requirement in order to submit those two components of the SRF application. So the MOU that's before you today outlines the roles and responsibilities for the county and for South Feather in seeking application funds through the state, but it does not prohibit the partnership from seeking other grant funds and trying to proceed. It also provides an offerant, but if the SRF funds are not awarded, that we would be able to dissolve the MOU. Along with some other opportunities should that need arise on either side. But overall, we're really excited to be able to bring this to the board in such a timely manner. You know, but everybody knows that this is an issue in that community that's, you know, sought resolution for decades. And so for the county to have been able to select a consulting team to move this project forward in such a quick manner with, you know, just positive solutions is really exciting to be a part of. So we would ask that that the board adopt resolution 212909 and authorize the general manager to sign that MOU on behalf of the agency. And if you have any questions before that.
One question, when would be the start date?
Well, the funding application has to be submitted by the end, completed and submitted by the end of the year. So we're looking at a, you know, hopeful award time frame of April to June of 2022, and so
Great. Basically
it would be ready to go.
Look at how long this water's been bad out there, and finally, ka-ching.
Awesome. Any questions?
Awesome.
I feel obligated. This is not to sway your decision, but I just want to, Rick and I had a discussion about this. There's terminology in here about consolidation, that this is a consolidation project, agency is a logical choice for consolidation. This is technically not a consolidation. Consolidation is a legal term under state law, and this is an extension of service is how I would characterize it. But there are reasons why, I don't know if this was our engineering folks or if this was the county, but there are reasons why they want to use the phrase consolidation.
It's actually consolidation by annexation is what the state is asking the terminology to be.
We're trying to fit we're trying to make a square peg, square hole type situation here. But I want to be on record that this is not technically a legal consolidation. I'll leave it at that.
Okay.
Just to give a couple of more pieces of information about that. Historically, the terminology for consolidation was you have one small water system and maybe you have another small water system adjacent to that that is a little more technically advanced or financially solvent, and the small system that's having issues would consolidate with the adjacent system. That's also come into play where, Cal Water has been adjacent to a failing small water system. So historically, that term of consolidation meant that the more solvent and capable system would consolidate and receive that smaller failing system in order to keep water available to those customers. And it is correct that the area that we're looking at in Palermo does not have a small water system as defined by the state. They're all on individual wells, and because they're in the unincorporated area of the county, they are in fact represented by the county as their agent, if you will. So this is being looked at by the state as a consolidation by annexation, meaning that of their own free will, each one of those property owners would annex into the district. This is not us consolidating with a smaller system, it's not us overtaking, it's not us mandating, and therefore the partnership with the county and South Feather at the onset through this MOU to go through that process. So the county is acting as the representative agency of those unincorporated areas of Palermo.
Right.
Questions?
I want to make the motion, Rick, it's your neighborhood.
Fair enough.
Yeah.
I move adoption of resolution 21-29-09 approving to adopt the memorandum of understanding between Butte County and South Feather Water and Power Agency regarding development, implementation, and administration of the Palermo Clean Drinking Water Project. First, a second. Any public comments? No comments online?
Nothing in the inbox as of 4:52.
Awesome. All in favor?
Aye.
Aye. Four ayes.
Wow.
Thank you, Chris, for all your work. I appreciate it.
Thanks.
Very nice.
Wow. Very nice. Very nice.
All right. Public comments. A whole lot of red buttons up there.
No raised hands.
No raised hands.
And nothing in the email as of 4:52 p.m.
There she goes.
That was almost funny. Hi, there she goes. I want to give you compliments for having such well orchestrated meetings, having reports that are so well written. I enjoy reading it, and I enjoy seeing you discuss with a real discussion. And that's all I say about that. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thank you.
No additional public comments?
Nothing in the inbox as of 4:53.
Okay. Well, thank you, public. Let's go ahead and move into a couple information items. Tab 8.
Yes, thank you, directors.
So tab 8 information item is notice of vacancy. So last month, at last month's board meeting, I did have an information item in there, posted notice of vacancy. There needed to be some corrections and cleanups on that.
So Director Edwards' official last day was September 24th as director. We're standing here today as September 28th. So what you have in front of you in this information item is notice of vacancy for Division 4. We walk through the timeline. So if you have if someone would like to provide a statement of interest to pursue appointment of that role by you, the board, those need to be submitted by October 18th. Need to verify that you're qualified to be a director in that division, and then our agency map for Division 4 can be located. I've got that listed below under Publications Division Map. Here's what's important. So whoever is appointed by you to this seat will hold that office through the first Friday in December of 2022, which is the next election cycle. So then that seat will then be subject to the November 2022 election for the remaining of that term, and then would go through December 24th. So whoever fills the seat is until December of next year, and then if they choose to run and then are elected in the general election process, they would serve for the four-year term, or two-year term, excuse me, line up from there. The statements of interest are available here at the agency. Those are due by October 18th, like I've previously stated. And then what we'd like to do, ideally, is receive the statements of interest from anyone that are eligible to provide that. And similar as we've done in the past, those folks would come to our October board meeting, so our next board meeting, present to you, give you the opportunity to ask questions based on their submitted statements of interest. And in theory, if you feel there's a viable candidate, you would make an appointment at that board meeting, at October 26th board meeting. This notice will be posted for 15, or at least 15 days, a week of the term until appointment, on three or more conspicuous places and locations throughout the agency. The following page, you've seen this in the past, but this is what the statement of interest form looks like. So if you have anybody interested, or if you need copies of that, let me know, or staff will provide this to you, as well as point them here to the district.
Looks familiar.
Now, I bet it does. Now, last month I did communicate this notice of vacancy, and in that time frame, you actually have in front of you one person who has already echoed a statement of interest via an email communication to you. That's in front of you. They will need to fill out one of these forms, and I would anticipate, unless they change their mind, they would be here at the October board meeting to have the opportunity to present to you why they feel that they're a viable candidate to fulfill that role for the delivery of the term. That's the only one we've received since our communication last month so far.
She did a good job of hearing.
Yeah, there you go. So
it's really sad with COVID that the public can't attend these meetings and learn a little bit as they go.
Yeah.
But I think this lady's well qualified.
Well, and let's see who else.
We'll see
who else presents an interest. I think on the Director Wilburn selection, what did we have? Four, maybe five people that were interested in
the time? Have you had anybody call in express an interest?
In this one?
Yeah.
No, just this one individually so far. But we'll see, right?
Yeah,
so
well.
Today is kind of the clock to see who else might be interested.
Thank you, Ray.
Thank you,
Director.
Let's go to move on to tab 9.
Oh, that's good.
See you again.
So this information item is around water theft and storage. And so at last month's board meeting, Director Moreland and Director Hickman then supported that request to actually have an agenda item to talk in more depth around water theft and then potential water storage ideas, opportunities within the district, etc. So the first document I have in here is around water theft. It's a reminder of the July board adoption of water theft policy. Now, Director Moreland, you were actually absent that board meeting, so you hadn't seen that at that point. So it might be a little bit new to you. But we had walked through environmental health and safety risk management, walked through why we feel there's a need for a water theft policy. Since we've put that in play, that has actually improved some of our water theft challenges within the district. But we still have significant challenges around fire hydrants. So it's diminished a little bit, but we do have a policy around that. We'd like you, we'd be asking you as you talk on this information item, which Director Moreland and Fire Director Hickman would kind of lead a little bit on the topics,
If you feel that this needs to be bolstered in some way, et cetera, this was a starting point to help with that. But really, what's happening is we need to gain control of unaccounted for water and also water hammering on the system. But unaccounted for water is a challenge. So every time someone pulls water from a hydrant without a meter, that works against us in our reporting requirements. And as it stands this year, we have an executive order that's asking us to voluntarily reduce water consumption by 15%. And that's measured. We have to report, and they're comparing it to the same time frame from the previous year. So that water matters. That's harming this district. It's harming our ratepayers of the district by going through that process of that water being taken. So we need to continue to enforce and manage that and make this a problem, those folks. I've included the executive order so that you can read it as it's written right now. At some point, depending on how drought conditions may or may not change, a voluntary could become a mandatory, couldn't it? So that's why we need to take it serious. And we are being measured against it as we stand here. The second part of this information item is indeed around water storage. On the first map, which is also on the wall, which is a little bit clearer, this is the Swedes Flat area that I have circled in red. I know that Director Moreland in particular has had a multi-year interest in potential options and opportunities for that area for additional water storage for a number of reasons, including wildfire risk mitigation. Has some. There's a reason that it was on a map in 1922, and the reason was, if you kind of look at the topo map on the next page, the terrain allows for about a 600-foot depth over a period of an area, which could then take advantage of any water available on certain years of lower Honcutt creeks. So an additional water conveyance system that's currently not stored and managed within that area, and these are kind of hard to view, but it's to spark dialogue today. And then the third printout in there is a Google Earth kind of showing that waterway, if you will, through the center of the page, which is identified as lower Honcutt creek through there. I also included in front of you today another Google Earth image just to make you aware of some of the challenges as an agency we would have to at least understand and overcome from a residential standpoint in that area. In other words, there's a fair amount of ag in that area that would be flooded, you know, if we were to be successful in implementing something like this.
Are these all
flooded or flooded?
Flooded.
Okay. Are these all illegal pot growth?
From a high level evaluation, the answer is yes.
Yes.
And it could be in terms of 50,000 plants to give you an idea of the number of grows. So those are the types of things that we just need to call out, and the reality is because it ties to water theft and it also ties to advanced storage in certain rural areas, etc. So we just need to be open and aware of those.
They have plenty of water for their growth.
Well, yes and no. I mean, it basically dried up that little hot creek.
So what road is this, right?
So this is coming up off of Swedes Flat. So it's the primary road coming up through Swedes Flat. It's everything to the south of Swedes Flat.
Would it be any area on Swedes Flats above the bridge to the east?
Area of opportunity?
No, area. Any of these pot rows, or are they east of the bridge off of Swedes Flat?
They are. They start almost at the entrance into Swedes Flat off of Oro Bangor and actually wrap all the way up to the top, entering into mile in from Earl off of Fort Sumter.
Why is the county sheriff wiping these out?
Well, I don't know. I'm the general manager of a water power
district. Yeah.
But you just need to be aware, as we're talking targeted areas within our district, it doesn't mean you don't look for an opportunity, to add water storage, et cetera. We just need to have a SWOT analysis of our strengths, weaknesses, opportunities, and threats of such a topic.
Who owns the land?
All of that's private land ownership there. Yeah.
But there's not a lot of residents.
Not a lot of residents, no.
This is all black market.
By a lot of residents or not any residents?
There's some. There are residents. There are temporary dwellings, and then there's a few long-term dwellings.
Okay.
Todd came in Tuesday, looked all this over, and he'll add to it. We talked about the water storage, and then we talked about the water theft. And we thought, it's very difficult to lock all these fire hydrants up. In public safety, you really can't do that. Unless you coordinate an effort through the sheriff, the fire people, then it's a possibility you can lock them all down. But the reason they're stealing all this water, it's not just for marijuana. It's for everybody. Because our state and county hasn't built proper water storage. We have an opportunity to change that. That's why we met. And we feel that this one on Sweet Flat would be the best. And we spent a lot of time, and there's two locations. I got another little printout that'll show it, and I'll give it to you guys. But we got a lot of future work to explore all that. And that canyon, what it looks to us, is 200 feet of water storage. And the neighboring lake that looks similar would be Collins Lake. I think at the highest, it's 85 feet.
Right.
So you got a lot of water storage. You got an opportunity that's huge to help the salmon. You'll sell a part of that water in the summer. It'll go down the Hotcut Creek, what goes into the Feather at Lilo. And like we showed Doug LaMalfa from Feather River to Highway 70 Bridge, maybe a quarter mile to the east of that bridge, that's as far as those fish can make it. But if you put that water in a water cell down that Hotcut Creek at the right time of the year, you'll open up a new salmon spawn. So the environmentalists should like it, as well as fire prevention.
So if I may, so we don't disagree, right? So if you look at staff, not just me, we think any opportunity for increased water storage is a good thing.
It is.
Right? Both on existing conveyance systems, you know, in other words, expansion of some of our areas, which we'll talk about for a certain date, and then capture of other pass-through water, exactly what you were describing. What I would propose or ask, because this is a little bit out of our primary core skill set, is that we seek out and interface with outside consultants a little bit about grant funding opportunities. How do you manage the political, environmental, you know, how do you make things happen? You know, some of those that have walked in those shoes a little bit,
right,
and to get that moving. So I think what we'd be asking for is consideration, particularly with the upcoming 2022 budget, is a little bit of money with a task order in front of you, those types of things to help us along that path, because it's not an area that I'm can walk out the store right now.
What is a possibility that you could get Butte College and these students, and especially the guy that runs the computer department, to, there's all kinds of computer programs out that can draw this up for you, and these kids could do it for a project. Then once we get to that point, well, then you get the engineers stamp code approval on it and pick the area, go for it.
I wish it was that easy. I love your enthusiasm, but don't underestimate trying to stop water from flowing and the environmental impact. Now, this is certainly not to the scale of Centennial Dam Project or even Sites Reservoir, but not quite that easy. And that's why I think with some little bit of outside influence, it would be some good money spent to help. How do we get to the end? Begin with the end in mind, right? Mm-hmm. And absolutely, along the way, if there's opportunities with the local universities for maps and things like that, but they don't get us to the finish line. It's going to be experts in that industry that can help chase that.
All they can do is draw you up a rough sketch.
Right, but it all helps. Some of the pieces get you there.
What would be nice for these kids, say, hey, man, when I was in college, I drew up plans on that. Now I'm a project engineer. It gives incentive for them to work hard.
Yep.
And there's another thing you can do is encourage landowners to dig private storage lakes where any of your ditches run in and out, and you'd have to regulate that. It'd have to go in and out. And then in the winter, they all fill, and then you sell a little bit of water to them to keep their storage up. And you'd have extra storage. And you'd have another farm to fight fire, because who knows where this global warming's going. It may start raining again big time, but it might not. So we gotta step forward, encourage people to build.
Do you think or support the idea of staff and I trying to, you know, find a resource
you know, at minimal cost, but resources that can help us move this along or at least get better content in front of you on what the cans and cannots, how we approach it.
Yeah.
Are you supportive of us applying a little bit of effort to try
sure.
to find that?
Yeah, for that.
The big thing is finding the funding, finding the government to put it through.
But that would all come with some sort of consultant to help us with that. Where are monies for this very thing? You know, how why is it attracted to the state, and why would they be willing to help fund it? You know,
sure.
those types of things.
I would rather see each individual water district build these on their own, because you see how long it's taken sites to get going, and it's still not shovel ready. I don't know what the process going there. Why is it? Isn't that an emergency?
Yeah, so direction would be to go ahead and put aside, I mean, some time and effort into doing that.
That would be my advice, so we end up with a better work product, right? We need
right.
a good work product to yeah. make something stick with possibilities.
Right now, this is just all a big dream, but the dreams do come true if we just keep on.
Well, you have to try, but you
yeah,
also
right.
need to know your boundaries. You need to know your lanes of the cans and cannots, understand your hurdles, figure out how to overcome those to make it happen, like any other project.
Right.
Do we need you got both where you're really close by is all these quarries and down in the hot cup for you. Mm-hmm. And they're a good product right there. Close. Closer than any other people.
Do we need to set aside funding in our next budget? Or do we do you have a certain, I mean, how's that work? Can we say, I mean, spend up to a certain dollar amount?
What we would do is, assuming you're providing direction to staff and I to look at alternatives there, we'd identify the who's, so cost, schedule, performance, and then we would present to you if there's funding available in the current 2021 budget, and then what we'd be asking for in the 2022 budget. But again, I'm not talking about hundreds of thousands
sure.
of dollars here. I'm talking about, you know, an economical way to get those that do this on a day in, day out basis to get involved and not just recreate it from scratch. It's just a different location than work they've maybe done in the past for others.
Sure.
Dennis, have you looked out for companies that do this type of thing?
Huh?
Have you taken and looked out for companies that do this?
We've got a lot of great contractors. One of them is Granite, and they're used to working with South Heather. And I can also talk to operating engineers or leadership and get them involved.
We know how to build dams
right.
and create water storage. It's all that upfront work to get you through CEQAs and all those other things that are involved long before it's shoveled to ground.
Right.
We know how to do the back half.
Yeah.
Let's do all we can.
Yeah. And then on water theft, I would ask you guys to just kind of reread that policy. That is an issue for this district and for staff. We are constantly chasing people that are drafting off of our hydrants. Off those, and they're not taking that water. I can assure you, the ones that we are interfacing with and catching, if you will, are not taking it back to backfill a dry well to bathe with. So this water is being drawn for other ag purposes, and I can say that with absolute fact.
Yes.
So.
Sounds good. Thank you, Rick.
Thank
you.
Director Hickman, do you have anything to add on this information on today, please?
No, I just think this is a great opportunity with this location and specific here, and we are talking about just storage. We're not talking about power generation,
right.
So that, you know, notches it down a level as far as the complexity and actual real viability. I think a few years ago, I think I would have been with everybody else that thinks there's no chance of getting something like this down, but we are in a unique political climate right now, so if this ever is going to happen, now is the time. I think this location, if you look, there's no organized agriculture, there's really no organized valuable development in the area, so as far as land acquisition, it's never going to get any cheaper than it is right now to acquire what we need to acquire in this area. Strategically, it's a phenomenal location because this is above almost our entire viable district. I mean, we have parcels above this and around this, but
right.
the majority of our district that's using water and doing things with our water, you know, economically, development is below this, so, you know, it's got the gravity issue going for it. So everything is just right about this location. This area has been explored. What, there's nine, where we find nine different reservoir
yeah.
potential locations.
Yeah,
that
nine. Forbes Town? Oh,
yeah.
Also, on this map, there is another location to the east of Oro Bangor that they penciled out, but it didn't get marked in on the blue.
Oh, is that right?
Yeah. I can show you that.
Okay. But you're right on the climate, you know, between drought and wildfires, if there's ever a time, it's now to be getting busy. And that's why we need those that are influential and know how to open the right doors for us to get movement.
Yeah, and now's the time to do it, because the shame is the way politics work. We get a couple wet years and everybody's going to forget all about it. But really, we got to be thinking long term here, and you got to get it started. And again, I contend there's no better time than right now to get this started.
And in the future, you're going to see the wet years, and like you said, you're going to forget it. But there's going to be other droughts. And this water is very valuable, what's going on now. Through the road construction on Highway 70 to Marysville, there's going to be an influx of people getting out of the cities and wanting to move up here. And what do they want? They want water. They want a good place to move and make these little family farms, and it'll work.
I think we're all in agreement it's a good idea, so let's move forward with that.
Okay. And let's not forget, in the last 1,200 years, there's been an 80-year drought and a 30-year drought. We've been, the last 200 years have been wetter than historical averages. So, you know, what have we experienced in California? What, the 70s, 76 drought, that was a 5-year drought. Well, we've had, what, a 3 or 4 year drought here recently. I mean, can we even fathom a 30-year drought? 80-year drought,
yeah.
You know. I was in Mexico at one of the ruins earlier this year, and basically they live in this lush valley that they thrived there for hundreds of years, and then that 80-year drought was what eventually destroyed that civilization, and these beautiful structures on their way out, they burned it, you know, so nobody else could have it. A Spaniard came along in the 1600s and bought the land and started dismantling the cobbles to build his estate. There's real documented, history out there of what happens when you go into an extended drought. It's the end of your civilization, and it would be the end of ours. I mean, anything more than a 10-year drought at this point could be the end of California. So we got to do something.
Yeah, and who knows? I mean, it's because someone has to start this process, and then maybe others could learn from, in theory, a success here and adopt it to other locations.
What you can see, you get this going, these neighbor water districts can see that this can happen to us too, and the opportunity is there from Sacramento to Redding in these eastern foothills, as well as over on the west side. And Arnold Schwarzenegger, he had it right years ago. Don't build big dams. We'll hit all them uncontrolled streams that cause floods and put smaller reservoirs there, and there's your answer. But nobody listened to him. But we're listening.
And so you've answered my question. I just want to make sure that you as a board are okay with us applying effort and resources towards this topic and presenting you with some outside support help as well.
Most definitely. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you. Good director's reports. Dennis, you want to start us off?
Yeah. Oh, man. Okay. It's really been a tough year or so or more with this COVID. It is bad. I got a good friend of mine, Dan Fresher, that did the heating and air here in our houses. Heard last week that he is in the hospital with COVID really bad. Collapsed lung. And he was an anti-vax guy. Man, get your vaccinations. This stuff's got to go away. We got to get back to normal. And also want to thank staff. It's been a lot of hard work doing to make this probably, this is the best agenda I've ever seen in my life. This is very positive, the good stuff going. Thank you, thank you. That's all I got.
All right, John?
I'm just saying, the virus has affected a lot of people local, or seen die right now with it. And I'm not sure about vaccinations. I have a lot of family that's against it.
Yeah, there's a lot against it.
I have a lot of doctor friends that are saying it's important to do, but you do need to get a handle on it.
You got to get a handle on it.
Thank you. Todd?
I would like to thank staff as well for all the hard work on this project. I'm ecstatic about what's going on. Look what we've accomplished here recently under this poor power purchase agreement that we've been operating under with the lack of funds. Look what we've got done between the Bangor project, Palermo now, the community line. It's incredible what's going on. I'm excited about it all. I'm proud to be a part of it, and thank everybody for their participation.
Yeah, sounds like the recurring thing. You guys rocked out that new agreement. That's awesome. And I know you guys spent a ton of time on that. And, you know, it's nice to be able to put your talents to something positive instead of trying to put out fires and deal with previous issues. So I bet you're excited for that. And so it'll be nice to get that dialed in and kind of move into the next thing. It'll be exciting. I'm thrilled with the Palermo possibilities. So appreciate all the work on that. And so it's just good day to be South Valley. That's all I got.
Oh, one more I got to add to it. Over the years, you guys accomplished a lot of hard stuff, and you've never felt this bored. Everybody has really put it out there, and I want to thank you all personally and thank everybody that works here and keeps this place great.
Thank you, directors. Do I have to, any more comments before we can close it up?
Nothing on
the
line.
Wow.